Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I don't have a sponsor for this week's episode, but you guys made it possible through your amazing support through a bunch of different portals. First, I want to thank everybody who supports the show by going to patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging for each episode. My big supporters over there are Zachary Moroccan, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. Thank you guys so much. And thank you to everybody else who, pledges $1, $5, $10 each week. It's amazing. It helps me do this, actually dedicate a lot of time to it and dedicate a lot of energy to it because, doing a podcast doesn't really pay you anything. So thank you. Thank you for making this possible. I also want to thank over there through the PayPal portal, Lynn Fortman from Mercer Island, Washington. Thank you so much for your support as well. And again, thank you to everybody who supports in other ways, in non-financial ways, by going to iTunes and Stitcher and rating and reviewing the podcast, by telling your friends about the show. That's really huge. And by visiting the website, carasantamaria.com, maybe going to the store, shopping around for some cool Talk Nerdy swag. Also, you'll see there's a link on my website right now to Compass 120 Apparel, which is like a cool kind of atheist skepticism apparel company. And they made a specific t-shirt just for, or I guess featuring me. It's got a quote from me on it and my signature down at the bottom, in case you want to forge my signature for any reason, you can pick up one of those and it supports the show as well. All right. I'm really excited about this week's episode, mostly because Jenny, my guest, has been sitting patiently watching me say all of this. We just had lunch at Merrick's. You don't know where that is if you don't live in LA, but it was really good.
It's the best.
Jenny Churchill, this is super weird to introduce somebody while they're sitting here. I'm just going to say that you are a badass TV producer and that we've worked together for many, many years. And we'll talk about some of those jobs and some of those things and what it really means to be on the other side of the camera. Because I think that is not something that people often get to hear about. It's kind of through the looking glass a little bit.
Yeah, I'm super excited to be here, mostly because I'm quite confident that I'm going to take away the prize for your guest with the lowest IQ ever.
What? Ever.
Oh, come whatever. On. Cara, the last time I saw you was at a pool party of yours, and a 6-year-old was schooling me on dinosaur classifications.
That kid is really smart.
Okay.
He also told us that the reason he knows so much is because he got a book about dinosaurs as a reward for not making the bed wet at night for a week in a row, which is very sweet. No, but you know what? You're a news chick, like through and through. You've been doing this and you're quite young and you've been doing this for what, like a decade now?
Not quite. So I'm almost 30 and I've been doing this since I was 21. So almost,
yeah,
I guess.
Almost a decade. And I knew you. So just as a little background, but we'll get into it more. We worked together both on Take Part Live, which was the live daily show that we did for Pivot TV. So any fans who kind of came from that and came over to the podcast, you saw us there with Jacob Soboroff. Or you saw Jenny's handiwork. Actually, you were on air once.
One time, I think.
You may have seen her. And then prior to that, you were a producer on HuffPost Live. I did not work on HuffPost Live, but I was a science correspondent at HuffPost, and I came on HuffPost Live quite a lot, so we worked together there. And then prior to that, were you at RT?
Yes.
Did you come straight from RT? Okay, so you worked with Alona for many, many years. Is RT the first news job you had?
Sort of. I mean, it was the first legit job I had. I did like years of internships in local news before that. And then even before that, I did work at like a PBS affiliate in Bloomington, Indiana. So that was interesting.
And so did you... we were talking earlier. I love it when I podcast somebody after we have lunch because I can't remember what we've said on air and what we haven't. It's like when you have a dream and you don't know what's real. Or like when you grow up Mormon like me and you're trying to talk to kids about Bible things and then you start talking about Nephi and they're like, who the fuck is Nephi? And you're like, oh, that was a different book. they don't realize. Sorry, weird association. But we were talking about how you actually went to college originally to study art, or you wanted to? Wanted to go to art school,
and then I realized I wasn't that good at it, so that didn't really work out. But no, when I went to college, I had literally no idea what I wanted to do. And a roommate of mine at one point was like, "Oh, you should go into journalism because you don't have to know what you want to do, and you can do anything." Huh. And I was like, "Oh, that seems good." And then I ended up in this broadcast class, and like, it just all kind of went from there.
That's
but it was
cool.
an accident.
That kind of seems like good advice, though.
Yeah, she was smart.
It's like an open-ended. It's like you don't have to know what you want. You just have to find interesting things and study them and report on them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and she was like, you could do advertising. You could do marketing. You could do print. You could do. And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I just kind of floated. Actually, my whole life is kind of one big accident. I just like float along and like things happen. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's crazy. How did I end up here?
I love that, though. That's a big thing that I like to, if I am ever in a position of giving advice, which I think is super weird that I am ever found in a position, I'm like, me? You want advice from me? Like, I gave the commencement address last year at UCLA's, I think, like a molecular biology department. It was molecular
that, you know.
And something biotech. No, I'm probably really wrong here. It might have actually been evolutionary biology. But I gave the commencement address and a big spiel in my. I actually referenced Dazed and Confused.
Oh.
And I felt super old because some of the kids literally looked at me. They were like, I was like, you guys have seen this movie. Like, come on. But there's this scene in Dazed and Confused where the redhead chick is in the car with the two guys. And they're talking about what they want to be when they grow up and they don't know. And there's this whole rant that the one guy goes on, like, I'm sick of feeling like everything. Actually, I think the chick goes on the rant. I'm sick of feeling like everything we're doing right now is some preamble to something bigger.
Yeah.
And that's what I kind of tried to remind these kids of, like, you're in school, but you're alive right now. It's not like you're in school in preparation for your life. You have to realize that life is happening right now, and you have to understand that and experience it. And also, doors will be open for you. And if you're so narrowly focused on a goal that you came up with when you were in kindergarten, which is a huge problem with kids who go into the sciences.
Oh, for sure.
You've got to be like, oh, that's an interesting door. Maybe I'll try and walk through it, you know? And that's cool because it seems like that's been your philosophy kind of your whole life. Like, let's see what happens. Let's try it out.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing because for me, people ask me all the time, like, what's your goal? Where do you want to be? And I never have an answer to that question, which kind of puts people off. Like, they look at you like, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. Because I never know what I want to be doing next. And I think in the end, it's been amazing for me so far. I mean, who knows? I'll probably end up like not being able to retire and being 90 years old and like working in a Kroger somewhere.
Freelance life, baby.
Right? But I mean, it's been interesting because I never, if I had a plan, I never would have ended up in DC working for RT. Mm-hmm. I never then would have met Alona. So I never would have ended up out in LA for HuffPost Live. I never would have met you, which how weird would that be?
Mm-hmm.
Never would have done, I mean, it's like every thing I do just kind of is an accident, and then I go, that seems cool.
And isn't it funny how no matter how much training you have, and no matter how much, and granted, all of that's really important, you know, going to school and studying what you're studying or getting real world experience and being really focused and making sure that you have, you know, basic competency in things and in basic skills, but how important it is to just meet people and have relationships with them. That's everything. That's how you get every job.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if someone doesn't like you and they have an opportunity, like if Alona hadn't liked me, mm-hmm. right? And she had this opportunity to go to HuffPost Live, she would have never suggested that they talk to me and interview me. So it's like, you know, at the same time, though, if she really liked me and I was incompetent, she totally also wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
So it's like you gotta have both. But I think, you know, people get really caught up and I get it in the sciences, but people get really caught up on education. And I think mm-hmm. education is important to a point. But at least in what I do, everything I apply today is something I've learned from doing.
Yes.
Not in a textbook or not because some person in a lecture told me about it. So, I mean, yes. School is really important because you learn basic things and are not ignorant after you go to school. And I think college is important because it broadens your horizons about certain topics. And, you know, I actually think, though, the thing that I learned the most in school that I apply today is from my psychology minor.
Interesting.
Not even my journalism degree.
Because learning how to interact with people and understanding empathy and...
or where they're coming from and what their motivations might be.
Yeah, that's really important. And the truth of the matter is, like, let's say with journalism, for example, you are probably... like, I wish I had studied journalism in school. I think I would have been more prepared for the work that I've done. And there's a part of me that kind of wants to go back and maybe do some refresher work. But at the same time, there are a lot of journalists who didn't go to school or they didn't study journalism and they're very, very skilled. So it's one of those things where you're right. It totally helps. I think it gives you a chance to kind of start in at a higher level where you don't have to learn the basic ropes as much as other people. But at the same time, journalism, I've learned, I mean, being in the trenches, that like you learn by doing and you learn by fucking up.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the biggest lessons I've learned have been because I totally, totally screwed something up like beyond any reasonable level of okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, school plays a part, but really when it comes down to it, it's all about competency. Mm-hmm. And especially in television, if you are competent, it doesn't matter. No one cares where I went to school. No one cares where I did my last job. All anyone cares about is that the person I worked for last was like, this chick's really competent. Mm.
And also it's important because like I've seen you at work both in at HuffPost and at TPL. And these are both of those shows were live shows. So it's, there's a kind of newsroom pressure that you don't have the same, I mean, I've also worked on shows where you're producing for weeks and weeks and weeks and putting it together in a package. And there is a different kind of pressure there because you have deadlines all the same. You just have a little bit more time to do more producing and kind of clean up loose ends a little bit more. But in a live newsroom, like you're talking about competence, so much of it is about being able to make quick decisions. Like, oh. I've definitely seen people in the newsroom who just are noncommittal, who, like, fumble around trying to make a decision. And that's, like, it's toxic to getting anything done.
Oh, absolutely. I think a large portion of my success is probably, to some degree, that I am at least a little bit a narcissist.
Mm.
So I fully support my own decisions at all times, whether or not they're right. And that's all that matters when you're sitting in there and it's like, oh, we just had a guest drop out and we're going live with that segment in 3 minutes. How are you going to fill the next 12 minutes? You just make a decision.
Yeah, you have to. And then once you've made that decision, you can't go back on it. You can't halfway through being on live TV go like, oh, I changed my mind. What if we do this instead? Because your talent's out there with you in their ear.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, what do I do now? You know, and you can't be like, oh, sit tight. We're going to switch gears. That's something that some people don't realize, I think, is oftentimes when you're watching news, especially live or live to tape news, that's studio driven. We have an earpiece in our ear and we've got people in a booth who are giving us cues. I mean, it depends on the show. Some people are fed like lines.
Everything.
Yeah. And then other people, they're very hands off. When I used to do fill in work on the Young Turks, so many acronyms in my life that it takes. Yeah. I was like, TYT, what is TYT? Oh, not Take Part Live, the Young Turks. Back when it was a TV show on Current, the producers did nothing. I mean, it was very rare that Steve would talk in my ear at all. Genji was our director.
Oh,
same,
no way.
Yeah, same director from TPL. He would talk, you know, he might call, he was calling camera, really. So it was like, yeah. Steve might do a countdown to commercial. That's one of the most important things, because with TV, you can't, like, the feed actually cuts out. So you have to say, like, we're going to be right back, right? And you have to say it at the right time. But I've been on other shows, like on TPL, where REP was, like, talked way too much in my ear. And so it was always really nice when you were the one running the show, because you didn't really talk, except when need be, which I liked. It's very hard to interview somebody while somebody else is talking to you. I think that's like a crazy skill that I'm not sure many people have at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think with that, there's the interesting thing is there's a really big level of trust, mm-hmm. right, between a director or a producer and talent. And if you don't trust your talent to be able to navigate things, then that's going to deteriorate really quickly. But no, I mean, I think especially like when I would do segments with you, at HuffPost Live, why would I be in your ear during a segment about like PTSD and we're talking about neuroscience telling you what to say? Does that make any sense?
And you can tell the host because when we were at HuffPost Live, they would ask early on in the process at HuffPost Live, they would always try and put an IFB in my ear, which is the little earpiece that helps you hear. And I would be like, I don't want to wear an IFB on HuffPost Live. Like, you guys have a host. It was usually Jacob. Sometimes it was a loner or somebody else. You guys remember Jacob Soboroff? He's been on the podcast. He was my co-host at TPL, but at HuffPost Live, he was one of the hosts. And so he would interview me, and it's like you or Luke or whoever's running the show there, you tell Jacob when he has to end the segment. I do remember one time doing a story about poop. It was a really great story about poop.
What?
Yeah, poop transplants. There's this crazy whole backstory about there's people who can get, look this up, guys. Maybe I'll even have somebody on the podcast about it. It's really interesting. It's a bacterial infection you can get called C. difficile. People call it C. diff. It's called difficile because it's very hard to treat because you get this bacterial infection, you take antibiotics, and it wipes out all the good bacteria in your guts. And so then it comes back. And it's hard to keep your C. diff in check. And so the people who have C. diff have like years and years of horrible gut problems where they're just sick all the time. And it's very difficult to clear. And there have been people who've gotten portions of their intestines removed because it causes so much damage. And then there's a treatment that's not FDA approved yet, but that's been shown to be like 98%. It's just insane where people get poop transplants.
So you take someone else's poop
They'll put it in a blender.
I can't.
I know, it's crazy. And they'll put it like infuse it. And so what happens is,
Kara.
I know, it's crazy. This person has very healthy gut bacteria and it repopulates their intestines. They're cured. How did the first person figure this out? I don't know.
No. This is what I want to know. How do you approach people? Like, how do you find the poop donors?
Lots of times it's like a husband, a wife, a son, a daughter, which sounds crazy because it's like, it would be crazy if it was like, you know, you or me going like, hey, honey, I need your poop. But if you're somebody who's been so sick for so long, you'll do anything, you know, and you don't think about that. And now there's whole companies that make fake stuff. Like I think there's one called Repopulate. So it's like it repopulates your, and it's like fake poo with like all the right bacteria in it. Anyway, they found that it works incredibly. It's amazing. There's great articles written about it. And so I did a piece about it and Jacob was interviewing me about it. And apparently I wasn't, and you weren't producing. Luke was producing.
No,
that
I don't
piece.
Remember this one.
And Luke was like, stop talking about poop. Move on. Get off the poop. And I was like, no, I just want to talk about poop for a little bit longer.
Okay. That's amazing because apparently there was an abundance of poop-related stories done during that time period on HuffPost Live because I remember being assigned to and having to produce a segment that was basically the gist of the segment was, oh no, my baby just ate poop. And advice for young parents and all the things they don't. I don't know. So not my beat and not what I'm into.
Nancy the host on it?
Yeah,
because she was like the young mom host.
Yeah, which is great. And if that's your thing, but it's like I'm sitting there being like, can we talk about like privacy or anonymous or like anything?
And that was that was your beat heavily. Yeah. And I think a lot of that, and tell me if I'm wrong, a lot of that kind of came to be out of RT.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, our beat on that show was so specific in a lot of ways. I mean, it was U.S. politics, but our big beat was probably whistleblowers, privacy, freedom of speech, that kind of stuff. And I really didn't have an interest in those things before I started working on that show. I didn't really know to have an interest in that.
Sure. Yeah. And so, also, like you said, you were like 21 or something when you started there.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. I didn't know anything. Like before, I don't think I became politically aware until much later than 21.
Well, it's a funny story actually, because before I got that job, I was interviewing at local news stations. Mm-hmm. And I went to Waco, Texas to interview at a local news station.
Double Waco, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
It's special.
It is.
But I remember I was sitting in the news director's office and he gave me a foreign news quiz.
Huh.
And I was like, so not prepared. And I was like, I would never need to know these things. Yeah. And I was really angry. And I was taking the test and I didn't know any of the answers, like any of them. It was embarrassing how bad I did. And I just handed it back to him and I was like, I'm going to go now because I knew I didn't get the job and it was just so bad. And then like literally 2 months later, I was working at an international news channel.
Hilarious.
But no, it was
learning by doing.
Oh my God, such a steep. I remember sitting at my desk and Alona or Allison, Allison was the EP, would say, we need someone who's hawkish on national security. And I would Google what hawkish meant. Because I genuinely had no, I mean, I was pretty much an idiot.
And
I didn't
you were
know
like,
anything.
That could be me, maybe.
Yeah. I'm like, ah. So then I would have to learn what hawkish was. Then I would have to find someone who was hawkish.
Oh, yeah. Because a big thing for you guys was booking and booking with no notice.
Oh, booking with no notice. Booking on a channel that at the time was quite new.
Yeah, people, it was fledgling. Didn't, I mean, they knew about HuffPost, but they didn't really know.
Oh, no. This was at RT.
Oh, you had another producer named Allison at RT.
Yeah.
I'm so confused. I was like, oh. I thought Allison was your producer.
No.
That's true. Even now, RT has an interesting story tied to it because, and I don't know much about it, but there are people who really know RT and watch RT religiously. And then there are people who have never heard of RT. Mm-hmm. So RT is Russian television.
Yeah.
Right? And it's actually like umbrella produced out of Russia. And then you have these different affiliates.
No. Not exactly. Okay. So it's a lot of times when people don't know, ask me about it because it's on my resume. I'll explain it as RT is very similar to Al Jazeera.
Okay. I know about that.
but it's Moscow instead of Qatar, basically.
Instead of Doha. Gotcha. And so like Al Jazeera has Al Jazeera Arabic. It has Al Jazeera English. It has Al Jazeera America. And yes, Qatar oversees all of it. But there are these different kind of, it's even more than a bureau. There are bureaus within Al Jazeera America, but Al Jazeera America in many ways is its own functioning network. It just does ultimately answer to Qatar.
So, and that's how RT was, at least when I was there. Mm-hmm. I haven't worked there in years, but RT America was kind of its separate thing. All produced in the States. We, you know, had our own news broadcast, and I worked exclusively for the Alona Show. And the thing about that was the Alona Show aired on RT America as well as RT International.
Oh, interesting.
So it aired on both. So there was crossover. There's been a lot of controversy, obviously, since we've left about editorial and how much of that is dictated by the Russian government.
I mean, in some ways, very similar to what you see at Al Jazeera.
Yeah.
I mean, that happens all the time. When you have a network that's owned and operated and funded by the government, I mean, we see in America as that being a fundamental conflict of interest. Like the idea, our American culture is kind of built on this idea of, quote, free press.
But it's a sham.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, come on, Karen. Give me a break. Because here's the thing. I mean, listen. If you want to talk about when I was there with the Alona Show, we had editorial control over our own show, period. I know that's not always the case there. However, even if we hadn't, you're always answering to someone when you work in media.
And whether you're answering to a government or you're answering to your
corporation,
fucking advertisers.
Exactly.
That's what we're used to. I mean, that happened all the time at TPL.
So
All the time.
Do you remember that? It happens all the time everywhere.
There was a time when we had a really funny character on in a segment who was named after a cell phone company. And then there was a conflict there and we had to change the character's name because it was like, oh, wait, they might now be interested in funding something having to do with one of our talents. And all of a sudden they might see this as derogatory when it predated them. Like this shit happens all, even with silly stuff, even with stuff where you're like, well, just to be safe, we don't want to make anybody mad.
Yeah. It's, and you know, there's always someone that's pulling the strings. There's always someone you have to answer to. There's always someone that you're tiptoeing around.
And the sad thing is, it's usually somebody who it's oftentimes not even because of any sort of real important interest. It's literally because somebody's sensitive. Yeah. It's literally because like their feelings might get hurt or their daddy doesn't want them to be involved. It's just insane.
Well, and it's interesting too, because a lot of it actually I've found isn't even because the overlord of whatever you're working for would genuinely be upset. You're tiptoeing around and not do, you're self-censoring because you're afraid to rock that boat.
Yeah. Or,
which is almost more dangerous.
Yeah. Or it's like you've got the person who's in charge and then that person surrounds themselves by yes men, and those yes men, like they do, they over-censor because they're so afraid of getting yelled at that you end up kind of neutralizing the point.
Oh.
And,
absolutely.
And all of a sudden that really kind of hard edge of investigation or of kind of, the skewering that you want to do becomes softer and softer.
Totally.
And that must be hard. I mean, I've had questions about, I'm lucky enough, I work on a science show on Al Jazeera and I'm a freelance person. If they want to hire me, they hire me. If they don't want to hire me, they don't hire me. I'm not on staff. My contract is very loose. I'm lucky enough that like I do science programming. It's pretty clean. It's pretty easy. But we have friends. You and I both have friends who worked on my science show. They did a huge round of cuts and then they ended up literally moving to Qatar do reporting there. And it made me wonder, like, for example, if I worked for that bureau and I was like a sports reporter and I was trying to report on FIFA, would I be stagnated from talking about human rights violations there? I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that something that happens at RT?
Well, it didn't happen to us.
But it definitely, there have definitely been like huge scandals after you guys left.
We were incredibly lucky in that we left RT, in my opinion, at the exact right time, because it was right before everything happened with Pussy Riot.
Mm.
And also then, all of the stuff with Ukraine. There were a lot of things that happened quite quickly after we left.
Was it prior to Snowden as well?
Let's see. It was prior to Snowden.
Yeah, I think so.
Because we did the first interview with Julian Assange.
Gotcha. Ever. Gotcha.
But I'm not remembering where in the scheme of, because the show was on for 3 years.
So there wouldn't have been that much that kind of comes back to Russia. Oh. Like you didn't have to deal with the Crimea stuff and you didn't have to deal with Snowden's asylum.
No.
You didn't have to deal with anything and it was before the Olympics.
It was a weird, weird time of like kind of not much going on.
Mm-hmm.
There were nuclear talks that were happening. But I mean, the reality was, we were able to do stories on that show that we would never have been able to do at another media outlet in America.
Because you guys focused heavily on Privacy Act violations or privacy violations, Patriot Act, drone strikes,
yep,
American military operations that a lot of major news networks were stifled to be able to talk about because they want to keep their sources.
The Julian Assange thing. No one was paying attention to. This is back when collateral murder came out.
Mm-hmm.
There was an event at the press club in D.C. and we convinced him to come over and do this interview. No one was paying attention to it. No one was talking about it. And it's the type of thing where we would cover stories like that all the time.
Yeah.
Where we would cover the story weeks before other people would get on board because they wanted to ignore things as long as possible until it was literally, the big networks, until it was like smacking them in the face and they had no choice. But like Trayvon Martin, it took forever for the big stations to get on board with that story. So
because it's like, oh, it's too controversial. We're afraid we'll come in seeming like we're taking a side. We don't want to piss off our contacts with the police station. We don't want to piss off our contacts, with the federal government. I mean, that's a huge problem, I think, with a lot of major news networks is that they have sources within the government. And so they're very careful about, it gets to the point, it's like when you watch, Veep or you watch West Wing or something like that, where the press people are like, being told not to report on things right away, where the press people are being told, like, guys, just wait on this and we'll give you another scoop later. And there's deals being had all the time.
Absolutely. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I have a ton of friends from my time in DC mm-hmm. who work for bigger networks and who I respect deeply.
And who are White House correspondents, and, I'm sure. And yes. who actually get scoops and yes. who actually do good investigative reporting.
Absolutely. But there's a different, and actually, even when I was at RT, there's this weird push-pull, right, of access. And we had a really hard time in the beginning getting guests because what was our show and who are we? And then we're on a Russian network.
Yeah.
So that was a nightmare.
And Alona herself was very young.
Yes.
And so was this a thing where you guys got booked together or where Alona had the show and then you applied for her show?
No. So I actually just applied to work at that office in general. And then the day I started was the day the Alona show shot the pilot.
Gotcha.
And I immediately was like, I need to work on that show.
And who, like, not like who was she before that, but what about...
She was a correspondent.
She was for RT mm-hmm. previously. Gotcha, yeah. gotcha. And do you think that, because we use news, I think, as a very broad term now in American media... Do you think that what you guys, or even what we, definitely what we did at TPL was not news. It was like a political millennial comedy kind of a show. I don't know what it was. We were confused.
No one knew
what it was. That was a big problem. But on the Alona show or even at HuffPost Live, it's kind of a hybrid news opinion platform.
There is no straight news
anymore.
That does not exist.
That's what I was. That was really my question is like, and maybe it does in other countries.
I don't know about that. I would say that really the only straight news would be Associated Press. Mm-hmm. Anything that's not Associated Press, because listen, here's the bottom line. And this is something that, you know, when you're saying behind the scenes that people might not realize, no matter what show you're at, there's someone making the decisions of what's going to be discussed. Mm-hmm. So even if you present the news story in a let's show both sides, let's tell just the facts, you're still selecting what stories to cover.
Of course, you still have editorial control there.
There's some editorial happening on some level somewhere. Always.
And even just showing, I mean, I know this from doing science news reporting. Even just saying I'm going to show the facts is sometimes in conflict with showing both sides of a story. And so I'll report. I just did, actually. It hasn't aired yet, but it's going to air soon. I did a big report on GMOs. And, you know, I don't have full control. I'm a correspondent. So my EPs are going to be the ones who make the decisions about ultimately what makes it into the piece. And they shot a lot. They went to an anti-GMO rally. They shot kind of the other opinion. It's an attempt. It's a fully fledged and I think, you know, really noble attempt to say these are the facts on GMOs. This is what the science tells us. But there's a political argument there and there's a huge editorial angle that you have to take.
Well, totally. And if you look, OK, let's look at another example, which I actually don't like to bring up because people like hit the snooze button immediately. But if you look at a big topic like climate change.
Sure.
Right. And you want to do a story like, let's say, a straight news story, traditional, like they teach you in journalism school, story about climate change. Well, that means you have to get both sides. Mm-hmm. Now, at a certain point, are you supposed to give both sides equal representation? I mean, from my standpoint, I think that there isn't a both sides in that case. I would say that there is a side and then a crazy.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So you've got a situation then where it's like, so I give equal time to climate deniers and that makes it straight news and not opinion. That doesn't seem right.
And in essence, that actually in some ways makes it more opinion, or it even turns it into satire. Like, I had that problem. I went on TYT once, and Cenk didn't really tell me ahead of time that I was going to be conversing with a climate denier. Like, he was like, we're going to do a climate segment. And I was like, okay, great. And I tried to beef up. I'm not a climate scientist at all. It's not even, my background's in neuroscience. So when I got into science journalism, I had a lot to fucking learn.
Right.
It was the same thing, like, you were like, I need to look up hawkish. Yeah. But then I also need to look up a person who is hawkish about this thing. And I need to, what do I need to know about drone strikes? Let me learn everything I can right now about drones. I do that all the time. It's like, what do I know about this probe that's around Pluto? Holy fuck. I don't know anything. I got to learn. And so, they brought me on TYT and it was like a 50-50 split. And I just found myself being like rolling my eyes the whole time and being like, what is this? Like, you duped me into this, first of all, Jank. Thanks. And really, why did they do it? It was for entertainment. Well, it wasn't because it was like a legitimate news conversation.
But so that's part of the problem too, mm-hmm. right? And then you get into this tricky thing. Okay, so for example, I once booked a panel with Shirley from the Westboro Baptist Church.
Ooh, fun.
That was for the sole purpose of us showing how absurd they were.
Yeah.
Right? At the same time, we got slammed by a lot of our fans saying, why are you giving them airtime? And it's like, well, it was entertaining to us.
And then you also have the secondary problem of like, you can be more sensitive and you can be more kind of crass where you're like, why are we giving them airtime? They're delegitimate. They're not legitimate. We should. And then you've got this like, oh, are we just making fun of them for the sake of making fun of them? Oh. And like in some cases, you're like, Westboro Baptist Church, well, fuck them. You know, they're like the God hates fags people.
Years ago.
But then you have other things where like, I remember doing a segment, I think it was at HuffPost, and I don't know who produced it. Maybe you did. I don't think you did,
though. We'll find
out. I don't remember working with you on it. But it was about like a guy who claimed to be in some CIA, like the Pegasus Project, some program where... my neighbor just came home, so Killer Sparky Bark. It's okay, Killer, calm down. It was a guy who was claiming to have been involved in that, in like a CIA, like mind reading. Maybe not mind reading, but what did they call it? Remote sensing. You remember remote sensing? This idea of like, it was a project where they were supposed to go into a room and then like imagine that they're somewhere else. And it became very apparent, like,
I vaguely remember.
Yeah, it became very apparent like really 5 minutes nuts, into it, right? That he was nuts. He was just nuts.
And I didn't produce that, but I saw it go live. And I just remember being like, I had my hands on my face.
It's mortifying. And I found myself at first trying to be like, okay, well, you know what? We need to talk about the facts and blah, blah. And at first kind of trying to be not combative with him, but trying to contain the situation because I thought that he was, you know, there's a big difference between somebody who's a charlatan, who's a huckster, who's trying to make money off of something because, you know, and it's illegitimate and it's not scientific or it's not reason-based, and somebody who's like not well.
Yes.
And then you start to feel horribly guilty about it. And so I had very fucked up feelings after doing that segment for a while. Yeah. And that kind of shit happens in the news all the time.
It does.
Because what people don't realize, too, is that, like, there's just not enough time in the day to really vet every single person you're going to put on air. And
don't even get me started on that. One time, I shouldn't even say this. This was, like, the most embarrassing. I don't even know if I can say it. I'm not giving specifics because it was literally the most embarrassing thing I've ever done. But
as we talked about, learning from fucking up.
Oh, God. Oh, God. I booked a guest on a show at some point in my life who I didn't realize was actually a white supremacist.
Wow.
It was the worst.
And then those tendencies came out on air?
Yeah.
And you had them. You would book them for something else.
Yeah, it was like I didn't.
Yeah.
It was the worst feeling in the world because I was like, oh no.
It's like, cut the feed. Like, go to commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that shit happens.
It was awful.
Because that's another thing, too. There are people out there who have agendas and they want to use airtime.
But then they'll like have a blog post about something totally unrelated that you'll have them on about.
And that's how they get booked. And we've read articles, too, all the time about individuals who kind of like scam the system. Like this has been a topic I've seen on Twitter a lot with kind of my journalist professor friends, like people who are more academic journalists who teach journalism and who are really interested in the purity of journalism. And that there are people out there who have tried to basically hack journalism. Like they'll get booked as expert guests on things and then they'll, you know, pull some other agenda out, or they'll try and get something published as legitimate.
Oh, yeah.
And then it gets picked up by different outlets, and then it turns out that it was fraudulent. And part of the complaint about this is that there almost has to be an assumption at a certain point that things happen because they happen, and that people are people, and that they do things because they do them. And you almost can't just err on the side of everybody's trying to fuck you over.
Well,
because once you do that, then all of a sudden, I don't think anything will ever make it to air.
It's, we live in a very, very strange world, mm-hmm. Where news shows and networks are competing with social media. Mm-hmm. And social media is instant. And things can go viral by no, you know, with no vetting whatsoever. And so that happens all the time. And so when you're competing with social media and you're trying to stay relevant, you then in turn end up putting things on air that aren't fully vetted, that turn out to not be legit. And it's mortifying when it happens. Oh my God, it's so embarrassing when you put something on the air and then 2 days later, it turns out it's totally not
real. And then you have to issue a retraction. Like you have to try and do a make good. But as we know, like, there have been studies after studies that show that retractions don't have the same traction.
Oh, God. Yes. That's actually the craziest thing to me, is the fact that once you put a falsehood or a falsehood is put out there, it always exists. Because let's say there's an article that, you know, I don't know, Cara Santamaria is a demonic unicorn, mm-hmm. right? And so then there's a retraction 3 days later, like, oh no, she's actually not a demonic unicorn, okay? Anyone in the future who ever looks up Cara Santamaria demonic unicorn only sees the article about you being a demonic unicorn, right? So you are for the rest of time a demonic unicorn.
And also 50 sources have then picked this up and reprinted it, and nobody picked up the retraction.
No.
This is exactly what happened with the Wakefield studies and the vaccine autism link.
Yes.
Like, this is the, I think in many ways, a thesis of Seth Mnookin's book, The Panic Virus. He talks literally about how people wanted it to be true. They were looking for answers. They were scared. They had sick kids. And everybody said it was true. And then as soon as we realized it wasn't true, nobody heard that side of it.
Right.
It doesn't echo around the same way.
But that's the thing. Everything has become an echo chamber, mm-hmm. and it's become a situation where you follow the things that you want to follow, and you are exposed to the things that you want to be exposed to. So let's say I believe in God, and mm-hmm. you don't. I will populate my world with all types of things that reaffirm my belief in God, while you'll populate your world with all types of things that dispute it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So my feed to life just constantly reaffirms my belief, while yours does the same and the opposite. So it's interesting because the internet and social media and all of these things kind of open our world up, and we've never had more access to more information or more knowledge. But at the same time, we're so narrow about the things that we choose to expose ourselves to that we never actually step outside our box.
And that's only partially because those are our own search parameters. It's also partially because we live in a world of very intelligent algorithmic search engines where once they start to know your tastes, it's almost hard to find something that's not to your taste.
Oh my God. My favorite thing is the fact that the majority of people in the world, probably not your listeners because they're smart and not stupid, but the majority of people in the world are unaware of the concept of an incognito search window.
Mm.
So that's my favorite thing in the world, is when I'm searching for something, I open and I use, Google Chrome. Mm-hmm. So I open an incognito window to search, because then I know that it's free of all of my bias. So for example, anyone else out there who's a narcissist like me, if you ever want to Google yourself, never Google yourself in a normal search window, because you're going to get all the things that are tailored to you. Well, that's stupid. You want to see what, like, a completely clean slate non-human robot is going to find out.
I've never done that. That's so scary.
No, this is what you have to do, because, for example, if I Google myself, all kinds of things about myself come up because I'm me. If I Google my name in an incognito window, all kinds of things about Winston Churchill's mom
So how do you open an incognito window? Oh, there it is. New incognito window.
See? This is what I'm saying.
And it's got the blue bar. You've got incognito.
It's life-changing.
Okay, Cara Santa Maria.
You might be frightened of what
I know this might not be a good idea. At least the top hit is still my website.
That's great.
That's good. And the second hit is my Wikipedia page, which is not...
Fantastic.
It's not really correct, but it's sort of correct. I'm really good, though, about... Yeah, it's mostly just work on the first page. Oh, the searches related to me are pretty scary, though.
Oh, don't go down that road.
I know. I can't go down this road. It's starting to get bad. So.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's definitely a different world. You're right, because we don't think about the fact... A lot of that opened up for me when we were on TPL and I interviewed Cullen Hoback. He did Terms and Conditions.
Yes,
May Apply,
yes.
Which was
such a good documentary.
Yes. And it really helped me, I think, in many ways, understand exactly how much of what we do is so tailored to, you know, it's every keystroke we make gives so many corporations information about us.
It's the, in my opinion, the craziest thing, because we've literally just given corporations our very self. We've taken who we are as humans and turned it over to businesses in order for them to monetize us.
Mm-hmm.
With getting, I mean, literally, we've done this for the ability to see some high school person's photos of their baby or their drunken night out in a newsfeed, and we don't even actually care about them.
Exactly. It's like, oh, we're doing it, we're trading it for tailored quote unquote convenience. Not only are we not making any of this money off of ourselves, we're actually oftentimes paying money in order for these individuals. We're either doing it for free or we're literally paying money, like with the case of buying things off of iTunes
right.
or, you know, subscription services like that. Like Pandora, for example, I pay for Pandora every month. I'm sure they're learning all sorts of fucked up things about me based on my listening preferences.
Oh, yeah.
And then they're making money off of us, lots of money.
We have become the commodity.
Yeah.
We are the commodity. And yeah, I mean, it's so crazy and specific. I mean, all of your listeners know that moment when you search something and then suddenly your ads are awkwardly about that and you're embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a friend who was pregnant, and she mentioned to me that she couldn't find any good pregnancy bathing suits. So I was like, when I see a problem, I feel the need to fix it, whether or not I actually care. I don't care if she has good bathing suits. Like, who cares? But so I'm like, I can fix this. I can check that off the list. So I searched for a little while and like sent her some stuff. For the next 7 months, a large portion of my ads was pregnant women in bathing suits. Do you know how awkward that is when someone asks to use your laptop and the ads are of a pregnant woman in a bathing suit?
Yeah, or like when they're over your shoulder in the newsroom and you're trying to look up something like really serious or really somber.
Yeah. So weird. It happens to everyone, right?
It's true. Like right now, I'm in the process. Well, I actually bought a house and now we're in the process of renovating this house. And the truth of the matter is, it is kind of helpful. It's helpful, but it's frustrating because all of my banner ads now are for products that I've already been researching. And then I'll see a pop-up that's like, oh, that one bathtub, that's the bathtub I've been thinking about buying for the downstairs bathroom. And it's $15 cheaper on this website. Sold. I'll click through. You know, it's frustrating as fuck.
At the same time, though, yeah, you're right.
We like it.
And I mean, for me, I know that whenever possible, I go through and I change settings and I try to keep my shit locked down. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, we are our own worst enemy, right? Because if I really cared, I wouldn't partake in any of that, but I don't care enough because I need to be on Twitter to see what's going on and I need to.
Because we're trading privacy for convenience. I mean, that's what it comes down to, privacy for convenience. We do the same thing, I think, in our consumerism aspects of our life where we're trading trashing the planet for convenience.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not any different than buying a bottle of water at, you know, a plastic bottle of water at the convenience store. And I do it. I try not to. I say all the time that, like, I'm really adamant about carrying a reusable water bottle. I'm really adamant about, like, I'm a fiend for Coca-Cola, as most people who listen know. I try my best to always buy Mexican Coke in the bottle or to buy cans of Coke. I hate buying it in plastic bottles. A, because it tastes worse. But
it's
B,
so gross.
It's so
Who
gross.
Who drinks Coke out of a plastic
it's
bottle?
It's gross. It gets warm within five
it's
minutes.
Disgusting.
It goes flat. Whatever. But it's also terrible for the environment. Like, I hate plastic. I hate single-use consumer plastics. But at the same time, I'll tell you, if I'm on a shoot and they have plastic bottled water in Crafty and I can't carry around my bottle with me or I forgot it, I'm gonna do this. If I'm on a road trip and I need water and that's all they have at the convenience store, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm in a position where I can afford to buy it in a glass bottle. Some people can't.
So this is actually my thing. So a lot of my politics line closest to libertarian. I would say more libertarian than anything else.
Interesting.
Except where I get caught up is basically their biggest tenet. So it seems insane. The reason I line up with them is a lot of the privacy stuff, you know, freedom of speech, all that kind of stuff.
Legalization of drugs. What?
Yeah, just like personal freedoms.
Mm-hmm. And
personal
responsibility.
Yeah. I'm all about that, right? Here's where I fell off the wagon. The idea that the market can regulate itself. The idea that in an environmental space, like if you're talking about protecting the environment, that there shouldn't be government involvement and things like that because the market will regulate itself and people overall are good and people overall want the world to be okay. So they're going to back companies that then do things that are good for the environment, et cetera, et cetera. No,
which
that's not reality.
We all know it's not reality. And any economist will tell you it's not reality. I mean, you talk to like a Robert Reich, who I know is a very liberal economist, but also a very, very smart economist, and he will tell you point blank, people aren't fundamentally good. Well, he won't say that, but the gross activities of a culture, of a society, aren't fundamentally good. They're fundamentally greedy.
Yes.
That's going to be your core kind of activator. That's going to be the catalyst, is going to be greed. People are going to make decisions based on how they can make more money and based on how they can protect themselves.
Right. But the idea is that in a society where, yes, that corporations are going to make decisions based on making more money, but the idea is that it would be a setup where doing the right thing would make you the most money.
Yeah, which is only going to happen with regulation.
Right.
It's only going to. It's
but
just
at the same
insane
time,
to think that that couldn't be the case.
Yes, but then at the same time, you can't overregulate everything.
I know. So I mean, that's a big tenet of the GMO episode that I just recently did with Kevin Folta. A big reason that private farmers and university farmers can't compete with Monsanto and Dow is because of regulation, because only Monsanto and Dow can afford
exactly
to actually deregulate certain crops, because they have to go through EPA and they have to go through FDA and all of these different regulatory agencies. And they said, I can't remember the number now. It was something obscene. It was like $10,000, $100,000, maybe even $1 million over the lifetime of the crop. But it's a lot of money to deregulate a crop. And so unless that's the reason that there's only like 7 or 8 massive GMOs, that's the reason that only the big ag crops are genetically modified, the corn, the sugar beet, the soy, because those make the most money.
Right.
And Kevin, the scientist that I had on, he's a strawberry scientist. He's like, I can't deregulate my strawberries. I can't fucking afford that. I'm a public servant.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting too, because you can actually take that same thought process and apply it back to the media, right? Mm-hmm. Because you've got a situation there where if you just let the media market kind of dictate what it's going to do and not regulate at all, you end up with like a very, very depressing product, right? It's all, you know, that dumb family on E whose name I refuse to say.
I love that you refuse to say it.
No, won't do it. and, you know, all of these stories that literally just make us dumber.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have someone there being kind of the gatekeeper, regulating what is being talked about, it devolves. But at the same time, when you have a situation where the gatekeepers get too clamped down, down, then you're not seeing the full story.
Yeah, and then that's, it's totalitarian. Then it's like the exact opposite of what you want.
Yeah, and that's the case with, in my opinion, most of the media that's out there, is you're getting a very small slice of reality and you're getting a very small slice of the story, of each individual story and the stories that are out there at large. And there unless really you're is. Proactive about finding those other stories and the other sides to the stories that you might not being spoon-fed, you will never know.
Which most people, not only do they not have the time to do it because they're experts in their own fields and they're trying to do their own jobs full time, they also oftentimes don't even know how to go about getting the full story. I mean, that's something that, you know, is a skill that, for example, you possess as a producer. But that's what you do for a living, is you try to offer the general public a more kind of opened view of a story. And what we're being spoon-fed is not only very narrow, it's oftentimes very specific to a certain
end game.
Yeah, like a certain agenda. And it's also very domestic. Do you notice that?
Yeah.
Like, we just suck at foreign policy. We suck at foreign
anything. Well, we don't care.
Anything. We don't care. We're so isolationist here.
It's interesting because that's the market drives what is covered, right? So if people actually cared what was happening in other countries, it would be covered more because it would be worth more to advertisers, et cetera, because more people would tune in. It's actually the reality is, at the end of the day, it's not the media companies that's the problem. It's us. Because if we didn't watch obsessively about a missing plane for weeks longer than it should be something that's watched about obsessively, it wouldn't happen, right? That wouldn't be what was on the air. If it's like if you go to the paparazzi thing, right? And celebrities are like, oh, our privacy, we're the problem. The paparazzi aren't the problem. It's the fact that we buy the magazines. It's the fact that we numb ourselves with this crap and walk up and say, please, sir, may I have another? But it's us.
I think that this is why we do need regulation and we do need editorial focus, because I not that I'm going to push back that we are the problem, because I totally agree with that. But I've mentioned this on the show before, and it's hard for me to source it out. But there was a publicist that I was working with when I interviewed a very prominent scientist, and she was just incredibly knowledgeable and interesting. We had some side conversations, and her father worked in media, like in the Cronkite days, like way back when media, when, you know, news shows weren't based on profits. They took the profits.
You mean back when integrity was a
thing?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, okay. So back when how it worked was that an ABC and NBC, they would make advertising money on their entertainment programming, and then a portion of all of that money would go to fund the news. And the news itself was never linked to advertising. And the news, they knew from the get-go, the news loses money for the network, but it's a public service. And remember, that, again, is regulation. Early on, there were mandates because the government owned the airwaves. And the government said, if you're going to do this and you're going to profit on it, you have to set aside a certain percentage of your airtime to educational programming. And that still exists to some extent today, but it's been bastardized. And she quoted her father. It's a thing, like her father heard a network executive saying this once, but it was something along the line. And I've said it a million different ways. I think I used foie gras as an example, which is not a good one. So we'll use filet. If you feed the people filet, they will eat filet. If you feed them hamburger, they'll eat hamburger. And I think that to a huge extent, that's true. If they feel like they don't have any other options. So it's one of those things where it's the tail, it's the snake that's biting its tail. It's a bad negative feedback loop where everybody is at play.
Well, and that's absolutely true. But the reality is it's a Pandora's box, right? Because now we have so many options that you can never clamp back down and say you can only have hamburger, because there's going to be somebody out there who has filet.
Yeah.
That's just the truth.
That's true. But I think part of the problem is that we talk about, and I think it's also because we're young and we're savvy and we know new media, but a huge portion of the country it lives in what, you know, we kind of sneeringly call flyover states. They live in middle America and they still watch the 10 o'clock news at night. And they're not even on Twitter. They're mostly not on Facebook. A lot more people are on Facebook, but they get their news from watching television and from reading the local paper. This is still a paradigm that exists in a huge portion of this country, especially with an older sect. And part of the problem is that, as we said, the news has become more of a profit motive. It's become entertainment first. If it bleeds, it leads. You know, chase scenes, tornadoes, devastation, and you said the missing plane. I mean, that's like the big embarrassing kind of, like, Jesus Christ, you guys. And that becomes what...
Psychics. They brought in psychics to find where the plane was.
Horrifying.
I can't even.
And this is what becomes our standard. I mean, CNN has become the standard for American news. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically super depressing, and we should all just kill ourselves. Thank you so much for tuning in to Talk Nerdy. I hope that the rest of your day is just as rosy and cheery as this conversation's been.
Yeah, like, how do we change this, really? So, but this is something that you're working in many ways against. And granted, you are just like anybody else in this business. You're a freelancer. I'm a freelancer who does on-air work and a little bit of behind the scenes. You're a freelancer who mostly does behind the scenes work. We work to make money. And we work to fulfill our passions, right?
Like, no, I'm like Jesus, kind of. I work for the people.
Just work for the people. You don't care about anything else.
No, yeah, just nail me to the cross. I'm just here. I don't get a paycheck. I don't, do anything for any reason other than all that is pure and holy.
All that is pure and holy is what Jenny does. it's true, you guys. But... the funny thing is, like, we do have to sometimes make decisions of that course. Just give us a paycheck.
Yeah, and there's definitely been times where I felt dirty.
Yeah, me too. And then there's other times where you feel really good about the work you're doing and you're like, I can't believe I get paid to do this, even if I get paid shit. I'll tell you right now, hands down, and I'm not going to give specifics, one of my favorite shows to work on is SoCal Connected on KCET, which is a public television station. I make less than half of my regular day rate when I do those stories. I do it for very little pay and I love it. And partly it's because the stories I have a lot of editorial control over. I have a lot of freedom. I have a lot of support there. And there's just a different vibe in the newsroom. It's not that cutthroat. And I think part of it is because everybody knows it's public TV. Everybody's underpaid, but they're doing a public service. So there's no reason to be like backstabby or like be really stressed about timelines. It's just like a calm newsroom to work in. And I really enjoy that.
That it was the same when I was working when I did the PBS affiliate, and it was really great because you go out and cover a story, literal story I covered. You go out and cover a story about the smallest piece of land ever sold.
Yeah,
it was 1 square inch by 1 square inch. And it's like it mattered because you wanted your product to be good. And of course, you wanted people to watch, but it didn't really matter.
And you also knew your parameters. There's kind of a, well, I've got a single camera. I'm lucky if I get sound. I have, you know, we don't put music in our pieces. We work with what we have and we make really good products. And this show constantly wins local Emmys. I'm up for a couple local Emmys this year, which is freaking weird and awesome. I'm like really excited. And it's the only show that I work on that's like that. That's like, you know, acclaimed critically. But the production values aren't nearly what they are on these other shows that I do that have money, but it's I don't know, it's like purer,
yeah,
in a way. Like the stories are pure. Some of them are really important investigative stories. Some of them are total fluffy public interest pieces.
And that's okay.
And that's okay because it's interesting to people, and I think it connects them to their local community, which is something that a lot of people are missing.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also at the end of the day, it's like, listen, I can sit here and talk about dumb stories being covered versus important stories being covered. Listen, you can't have if you had a show of all the stories I find personally important put together, that would be a show to slay your wrist.
Yeah, it would be really depressing.
It's just like, and I enjoy doing things that are fun, and I will do things, you know, things come up and I'll be like, this is solely 100% fun and I'm going to do that because everything doesn't have to be so serious all the time, but it has to be serious sometimes.
And the news is different. You know what I mean? Like, media is media. It runs the gamut from entertainment to, you know, thinky pieces to feely pieces to, you know, stupid to sad to angry. But, like, the news is supposed to inform you first. It's not supposed to entertain you first. It's just different. And granted, you and I have worked on shows that they're not news shows. They're political shows, right, or they're shows that have opinion pieces. And there it is important to entertain. This is a mantra I deal with all the time in science programming. I want to have science programming, but if it's not entertaining, nobody's going to buy it. Exactly. It has to be entertaining before it's informative.
Yeah.
And that's something that a lot of people are like in the science community get really bitchy about. They're like, ooh, that's horrible. And I'm like, good luck selling your show, dude. Like, let's work from within the system.
But that's true with news, too.
It's now. That's a sad thing.
But if it's something that people aren't, but no, it's not even like it is now. Here's the thing. If it's something that people don't find interesting, they won't watch.
That's true.
They'll turn on Netflix. They'll change the channel.
But I do think interesting and entertaining are two different things.
Correct.
You know, I think something can be done an intriguing and interesting way and still be fully informative that's not entertaining. And that's where, like, the car chase shit starts to piss me off, because I do think that news should be held to a different standard.
I don't know, man. I love a good car chase. Oh, there was an incredible... Okay, so any listeners that aren't in California don't understand the car chase thing out here, because there's one about every 3 days. And they
and
just...
And the cops are wizards.
Whoa. Dude, I saw one a few weeks ago that was a slow speed car chase.
Okay. Like, you were on the road or you saw it
on
the news?
No, on the news. Uh-huh. I've never actually seen one in person. I haven't been that lucky. But this was the slowest car chase. I think they were going like 15 miles an hour. It was the most baffling, entertaining, amazing thing. And actually, on shows I've worked on, that's... Listen, you can knock entertainment news all you want. Don't you knock a car chase, because I have never seen a room of people completely shut down the way they will if there's a car chase on TV. Everybody freezes. That's like a universal thing. You can't help but watch.
Like, the
you're
bars
just
get
sucked
silent.
In. Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. The car chase now owns you.
And that's a big... Why is that a big SoCal thing? People love to run from
people
the cops.
People run here. It's bizarre.
And the cops are like crazy with their maneuvers here. I mean, the cops, there's a lot you can say about LAPD. there's a lot of things you can say. But there's this thing that the cops do that in LA.
The swerve back and forth that I've
never seen anywhere else. So you and I both grew up in the South. Mm-hmm. I'm Texas, you're Kentucky.
Yep.
Interested to see if people can hear that in our voices.
Oh, you think so?
I think we have neutral accents, but I do sometimes get told, like, oh yeah, it's obviously you're from Texas. And I'm like, seriously?
No, I think those... I mean, listen, I think those people are messing with you. I always say I don't have an accent, but people always think they don't have an accent. Yeah. That everyone else has an accent.
It's true, actually. So. But Kentucky and Texas are places where people have accent. Like, my family sound like rednecks.
Yeah.
What about your family?
Nah. My mom's from Lexington. So like, if she's really upset or really angry, there's like a serious... Well, and the Kentucky accent's bad.
It's bad. And that's why, like, my father's born and bred in Texas, so you can hear his accent. My mom's a New Yorker, so she doesn't really have an accent at all. Although she does say diabetes.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Wilford Brimley style. But my sister, grew up in Texas and then lived in Arkansas and New Orleans.
Oh, Arkansas's a rough one.
Arkansas, New Orleans, Dallas is a weird hybrid accent. But anyway, the thing that cops do in LA is super crazy. One squad car can shut down a whole... freeway of traffic by itself. Like, this happened to me once. I was in the car.
Happens to me all the time.
It was so weird. I was in the car. There was, I guess, a sofa in the road, and they needed to clear the sofa. And what they do is they slowly swerve in their own lane, and then it opens up to two lanes, into three lanes. Eventually, they're swerving across, let's say, all six lanes of traffic, and everybody just kind of knows to slow down and let them do it. Yep. And then they'll park, like, horizontally in the road and take care of their business, and all of the traffic stopped by one single dude.
Yep, they do. Brilliant. It's happened to me all the time, to the point where I feel like they're just messing with me now. And it's like, anytime I get on the 405, they're like, shut it down, shut it down.
Jenny's on the road, you guys.
It pisses me off. And sometimes I can't even, I never find out what it is that they're doing. Sometimes you'll see, like, they'll have to go grab something out of the middle of the road and move it. I'm thinking what's happening is I'm always right behind a car chase. Like, I'm so close, yet so far away. Because they do. They shut it down when those happen. So, like, there's less people on the roads.
Yeah, that's true, actually. Because then nobody's going to get injured by the 15-mile-an-hour driver.
It was amazing. Oh, God. I hope it's on YouTube. Look it up. It was, I guess it's not the same if you're not watching it live, though. Who wants to watch a slow speed car chase on YouTube? But live, it was like, how is this happening? Why is this not ended?
Just run next to him.
End it. It was great. It went on a long time.
You know, it could be because I never take the 405, ever.
Oh.
I avoid it at all costs. This is quickly devolving into a very
LA we're not talking about anything.
We're not going to
about it.
We're not going to talk about freeways anymore. I love this about Talk Nerdy. I wonder if my listeners have a love-hate relationship with it or if they are annoyed by it. But I love that I often have guests on who are like really interesting and important people, and I just like shoot the shit with them. And sometimes we never even get to, like, when I had Don Johansson on, who was the guy who discovered Lucy, like the fossil Lucy. And we talked about the discovery, but we also talked about being an atheist, and we talked about getting shit from your, you know, colleagues for it. And even at the end, he was like, we didn't really get that into the discovery. And I was like, I know. But also, like, every interview ever with Don Johansson is like that. So I sometimes wonder if my shooting the shit nature is fulfilling to the people listening, and also my nature of kind of going in. Like, we were talking earlier when we were having lunch, and it was like, what are we going to talk about? I don't know. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. And then
I'm just wondering, just for my own knowledge, did you just, in a way, sort of indirectly compare me in importance to the person who discovered Lucy?
I think I might have.
Great. Okay, so today was a win, basically. I feel good about that.
As you should.
Your listeners may take issue with that.
I don't think they will. I think that that they're loving you.
You have no idea.
I don't know. I feel like I know my listeners pretty well.
I feel the backlash. I feel it already.
I don't think so. I think we're going to see some niceness on Twitter tomorrow. We're actually recording this the day before it's going live, which is fun.
I've not done Twitter, by the way, like at all lately.
Oh, get on tomorrow.
Now I know.
I'll be tweeting about the podcast, and you'll have people saying things like, yeah, you totally sound like you're from Kentucky, or like, I don't hear the accent at all.
I took a mental health break from Twitter.
It's a good idea.
About 6 months.
I know. I would lose my shit.
I know. It was really crazy. People were like worried I was dead. And by people, I mean like my 3 followers who actually like listen to what I say. they were quite concerned. And I went back to Twitter for the first time with the SCOTUS ruling about marriage equality.
So just a couple days ago.
Yeah. So I tweeted. And then now I've been looking again. I'm kind of lurking at this point. I'm not participating as much as I'm lurking.
I'm more of a lurker. I got to be honest. You know, I tweet because I think it's important, and because I think that the people who I have a fair amount of people that follow me on Twitter, and like, it's shitty if I never do anything on Twitter. So once in a while, I'll tweet a picture of my dog because he's fucking cute and people like it.
Yeah, Keller's cute.
Yeah, and I'll say things that might be interesting. Mostly I retweet other people because they're, you know, more interesting than I am. But I use Twitter as my news reader.
Me too.
You know, I follow AP and Reuters and everything, you know, that matters to me on Twitter. And that's where I get my news. That's how I learn everything. I hardly ever watch the news anymore. That's how I knew about marriage equality. That's how I knew about, I mean, about the SCOTUS ruling.
Yeah.
Not just, that's how I knew about the concept of marriage equality.
Do you know what the funniest thing was? When I took a break, my hard break from Twitter, the way I learned about stories turned out to be people asking me my opinion on stories.
Oh, hilarious. And you're like, oh, yeah, that was really interesting. Give me 30 minutes.
Yep. Because I just didn't know things.
Well,
anymore.
That's a skill you develop, too. It's a skill you develop when you, I mean, I developed that skill from being on air all the time.
How to bullshit.
How to answer the question you want to answer instead of the question that was asked of you because you don't know the answer to that question. But I was going to say, per the marriage equality thing, my very last tweet, actually, as of right now, might have changed by tomorrow, was a retweet from, do you follow Los Feliz Daycare?
I'm sorry, no.
Okay, it's hilarious. So I just bought, the house we just bought is in Los Feliz, and it makes me laugh because Los Feliz is like, in some ways, kind of yuppie and ridiculous, and in other ways, you know, like a really cool kind of liberal and progressive and fun place to live. So I'm excited about the change from Hollywood to Los Feliz. Anyway, there's a really funny account on Twitter called Los Feliz Daycare, which is a parody account of like yuppie parents.
Oh.
And it's very, you know, juice fed, whatever. And
I
all
see.
The kids have funny names. And so the most recent one that I retweeted was, any parents that haven't changed their Facebook profile picture to the pride filter run risk of extra volunteer time in the community garden. So good.
That's like,
you have to follow them. They're so funny. Anybody listening, you'll love it. We don't believe in competition, organized sports, or anthropomorphism. So if we had a school mascot, it would be the concept of love and equality. It's just so good.
Wow. And that's where you're moving.
That's where I'm moving. It's not really like that there.
It's kind of really like that here.
Oh, stop. Well, you're in West Hollywood. You're like in Boys Town. You're like right in the middle of the gayborhood, aren't you?
I am the gayborhood.
You are the gayborhood. That's where we had lunch today. It was like probably one of the gayer restaurants in LA, which I love. It is. It's a very gay restaurant.
It actually is.
Which is weird because it's also the only good Tex-Mex restaurant in LA, because I love queso. I love Texas food. And it's the only place I can go for queso. But it's also so, that's so contradictory, because you think of Tex-Mex and you think of like gay bashing.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. I love living in WeHo. It's clean. People are nice.
There's a lot of man meat.
Lots of good eye to candy look at. Out there. Lots going on. Lots of events.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Things happen. Here's the thing, though. I hate it because I have a dog, and I have to walk my dog in the morning. And when I wake up in the morning, I look like a sea monster coming out of my apartment with my dog. And I'm judged, man.
Oh, it's a judgy part of town for sure. This is like, the gym is your church.
Yeah.
People are, I mean, there are guys when I'm in WeHo that are wearing way more makeup than I am, that are tanned, that are tight, that are, you know.
Every person in WeHo is more beautiful than I am at all times.
Than you and me combined. It's pretty insane. I could see that. That would be tough. Also, the parking sucks.
I have a garage.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Okay, random. Anyway, we've gone not over, but like we've been talking for a long time, which I've quite enjoyed, but I end every episode the same. Oh, I was trying to say earlier that like we just babble. I don't know. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't get to?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, sure. Yes. I had actually, Kara, now that you bring it up, I had like at least 37 super smart, important things I was going to say. But like you said, you just babbled the whole time. So I was unable to impart my wisdom on your listeners, which is fine. I mean, they know what to expect from you. It's okay. But I mean, just because you bring it up.
Fuck. Okay, now I want you guys to Twitter bomb Jenny, asking her about these really important things.
Let's see. I'm going to focus on astrophysics and molecular biology.
The molecular side of it's the important side, really. Yeah. So anyway, though, I do end every podcast episode asking the same two questions. And I'm always really interested to see what people's responses will be, because I like to interview so many people with different areas of expertise. And sometimes we hear the same things a lot, and sometimes we hear really cool different things. So I'm going to ask you those two questions, kind of putting you on the spot. But we're excited to hear what you have to say. So the first one is that when you look to the future, in whatever context that matters to you, whether it's like a narcissistic, very personal, like my own life context, or a more global, like societal kind of a context. First, the depressing one, what is the thing that makes you like literally the most concerned, that keeps you up the most at night, that you're really kind of worried about? And on the flip side, when you look to the future, what are you the most optimistic about? What are you the most excited about?
I would say the thing that I'm most concerned about is the fact that I quite definitely believe that the movie WALL-E was prophetic and not fiction.
Oh.
I believe that as a human race, we are on the way out. We have hit like the evolutionary curve, and now we have become too intelligent to the point where we have made things so convenient for ourselves and so easy for ourselves that now we will slowly deteriorate. I think that we in many ways have reached the peak. At the same time, the flip side of that coin is the fact that I believe that every day is a different day, and every day there is the opportunity for things to be completely different. I, like a small child, believe that tomorrow I could wake up and there could be dinosaurs again. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. Tomorrow hasn't happened. I have no idea what's going to happen. Maybe tomorrow someone will be born who can fly. And that would be crazy. So as much as I'm kind of on this downward depressing spiral about the future, I'm also very hopeful that everything could change tomorrow and be totally different and the trajectory could completely change.
And a lot of that really has to do with, like, you know, having a Gandhi-like figure, having a, you know, sometimes it really comes down to like a single person who can rally people and really change the social kind of awareness of a certain issue. But I love that you brought that, because a lot of people talk about climate change, or they talk about, you know, the horrible things we're doing to the planet and the horrible things we're doing to ourselves. What a pure and simple way to describe it's so true. Like, WALL-E is actually a very depressing movie. I mean, it's beautiful and wonderful because they anthropomorphize the robots so much that when you're, you know, empathizing with them, you feel a lot. But the minute you go to the people,
it's gross.
It's so scary. It's like that whole thing about, like, your bones
have
shrunk into tear, and they're just all like these big fat
blob jellies.
People.
Yeah. That's us. That's us, kids. I mean it, though. I mean, and yeah, but I do. So I.
But it can all change.
It can all change.
And it has so many times throughout history. Things have changed rapidly for the worse, but they've also rapidly changed for the better. Yeah. And there have been huge, like, who would have thought that, you know, apartheid would have ended? Who would have thought that slavery would have ended here? I mean, people would have thought that for sure. People wanted that, but really the deck seemed to be stacked against it. Yeah. But it happened.
So I guess really in simplest terms, my biggest fear is the trajectory. Mm-hmm. And my biggest hope is the unknown that could change that trajectory.
I like it.
Yeah,
that's good. All right. So because I've told everybody that they need to Twitter bomb you, you need to tell them where they can find you on Twitter.
Oh, it's just at Jenny Churchill, JennyChurchill.
That's the easiest. Is that the easiest way for people to, you know, see you in social media and interact?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the easiest way for people to interact.
You don't have a website, do you?
No, I don't have a website. I have an Instagram. I think that's just at jenny.churchill. But that's just going to be a lot of weird pictures of me being weird.
But also pictures of her dog, Frank.
Oh, my dog, Frank, yeah. But
he's,
I mean,
really cute.
Yeah, and then I try to take cute pictures on Instagram, and then I just, it's weird. It's not good. So I'm sorry for anyone who happens to find themselves there. I'm so sorry.
And
they're
then,
not cute.
But then you can keep up, like, through her Twitter, which she never uses, apparently. But
no, I'm
going
to use
change.
It again. I'm doing it again.
And through her Instagram, maybe, to a lesser extent. But definitely through her Twitter, we can keep up with the work that Jenny's doing, with the cool shows that she's all, you know, she moves around. You're a freelancer, so you move around a lot. You do, you know, you'll do a show until it's done, or you'll do a show until you've gotten what you can out of it, and then you'll move on. And so you can follow up and see kind of the great news that she's reporting and the stories that are important to her. So keep your eyes open with that. Thank you, Jenny, so much for joining me. It was really fun.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in week after week. You're so amazing. And I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.